Well, good evening, everyone. You're all very welcome this evening to the next lecture in Shanghai on the LSE China Lecture Series. My name is Brendan Smith. I'm head of LSE China. I'm also an alumnus from LSE from 1999. And we have with us for the last couple of days in China our new director, Professor Calhoun. And Professor Calhoun was in Beijing for a couple of days visiting Peking University and meeting with central government agencies, which LSE has projects with, the People's Bank, the International Department of the Communist Party, MFA, the Health Ministry, and then we were down in Shanghai visiting Fudan University, and also we met with Vice Mayor Shen Xiaomin today on specifically on health projects and on some work with Shanghai Municipal Government on health reform and healthcare reform. And Craig is with us this evening to deliver his lecture. A distinguished academic, as you would expect from a new director and president of LSE. Craig essentially cut his teeth primarily in the United States. He is American. He studied, did his PhD or DPhil at Oxford. Didn't get into LSE. I'm not sure if he applied. And he was at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, for many years. He went on to be a dean there at the School of International Studies. His most recent postings have been at New York University, where he was a professor and also the director of the Institute of Public Knowledge. And he also held a very powerful position in the United States as president of the Social Science Research Council. He took up his post at LSE back in September 2012. And this is his first visit to China as LSE director. Now, he's been to China many times before. His first time in 1980 was his first visit to China, and he was in Shanghai. I think the last time he was in Shanghai was in 1984. So it's slightly changed in so he's going to speak to us tonight on the threats to capitalism. And please give him a very warm welcome. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Brendan. And let me thank Brendan on behalf of the school. It is terrific for the LSE to have him based here in China and working on the school's behalf in a variety of different ways, from establishing and caring for our joint degree programs at different universities, including Fudan here in Shanghai, and also our summer schools, our research relationships, our programs at a range of different agencies and organizations. So we benefit and you benefit because he also then acts to help with alumni association affairs. It's a thrill to be the new director of the LSE and to visit China in this capacity. As Brendan said, I have a much longer set of connections to China. But even if I didn't, I think it would be important for the LSE to be thinking about how to increase its work in China, its presence in the region of East Asia, and the opportunities and activities it provides for our Chinese students who come to London, for students in programs that work in both countries, and increasingly for other LSE students to be able to come to China. So expect to see more of me. And please send any advice or suggestions you have of ways in which the school can potentially work helpfully in Shanghai or in China more generally. But as Brendan said, my assignment tonight is to speak about what threatens capitalism now. That is, we've had a lot of discussions for 5 years now about a large financial crisis that has shaken many parts of the world economy, particularly but not only in the West. And what I want to talk about is what is the status moving forward? What are the big issues now on the agenda? And when I say what threatens capitalism now, by capitalism I mean the dynamic investment for economic growth, essentially fluid capital, capital that can be detached from specific enterprises and moved to others so that there can be an investment operation in which investments find the best possible home for the purpose of making money, in which the orientation of the system is to making money and to reinvesting that money in future growth, so that it is not harnessed simply to political power or simply to the consumption habits of the rich, but is organized to reinvestment and growth. The capitalist system in that sense extends beyond the limits of the countries most closely associated with it, like the United States, and influences global economic activity, including large parts of the economic activity of China. Although China remains a communist country in its commitments of its government and in large parts of economy, it also has enterprises that work according to this kind of capitalist logic. That is, they work with a fluid capital stream, investing in the production of goods and services for profit, employing free labor, moving the money where it can be more profitable, and pursuing this profit as a source not only of immediate consumption or political power or military might, though that exists, but also for reinvestment in continued growth. China has, in fact, been a quite remarkable success story, and indeed, in certain ways, a capitalist success story as well, even while remaining a socialist country, possibly pursuing capitalism with Chinese characteristics. Now, what I want to talk about, however, is some things that have both Chinese and Western elements, and some things that are particularly true of Western capitalism, and to ask about what the future holds for both, where it's similar, where it's different, how it connects. Capitalism seems unlikely to me to collapse anytime soon. So this is not a story that has the narrative of imminent collapse. There have been some accounts of the global financial crisis the last 5 years that have said it will be the terminal crisis of capitalism. I don't think so. I think that it is a serious, deep crisis that is extracting very large costs from the global economy and from people in many parts of the world, but it is unlikely to completely eliminate capitalism in the near future. That said, it's not obvious that capitalism will simply last forever or last forever in the same shape. We have a certain tendency to assume that a big system like capitalism is going to shape the world as we know it for the rest of our lives. We go to university, we get a master's in finance, we go to work, and we expect there to be some changes, but not so dramatic a change as the larger system. I would remind us that sometimes huge systems that were taken for granted do change, right? That the Soviet Union, for example, was taken for granted and assumed that it would continue by many people within it for a long time until it didn't. Right? Now, I don't think that capitalism actually confronts that sort of crisis. I think it appears to be surviving the worst financial and economic difficulties since the Great Depression of the 1930s, and generally surviving them. But the crisis is pretty deep and lingering. It is the longer period of lack of growth than occurred in what we call the Great Depression. Right? Growth rates have remained flat, sometimes negative, sometimes minimal, in the richer countries of the world longer than they did between 1929 and the resumption of growth in the middle 1930s. Right? So we didn't go quite as deep into depression, but we have had a harder time coming out of the financial difficulties of this period. So it should be seen as serious. It comes on the heels of a damaging era of lopsided financialization and neoliberal weakening of social institutions. By lopsided financialization, I mean the transformation of the global economy, and particularly the economy of the world's historically rich leading Western economies of Europe and North America, by a growth in finance capital. 30, 40 years ago, financial assets accounted for about one quarter of total wealth in the United States and in the rest of the so-called core economies of the world system. Right? By 2007, they accounted for 75%. So there had been a shift in the amount of wealth that was being held in the form of financial assets. This is crucial information for thinking about what happened in 2008, but the most important thing to remember about it is simply that the financial crisis of 2008 mattered a lot more because so much more wealth was held in the form of financial assets. It would always have mattered if there were a stock market crisis. There have been stock market crises before, bond market crises, fiscal crises, but the amount of the world's wealth was held in this form mattered. So one of the things that we'll talk about going forward is the way in which this still matters. But it suggests to me that capitalism is likely to be transformed, not eliminated, and arguably that the momentum of capitalism can be renewed, the momentum of economic growth, and capitalism is the most fantastic generator of economic growth we've ever seen, that it can be renewed only with some transformations. To think well about how capitalism might be renewed, and whether it may be transformed, though, we need to recognize that it isn't now, and it never has been, simply a perfectly self-contained system, and that the challenges it faces are not only economic from inside. Capitalism is and always has been an economic system that relates to political systems, to social conditions, even to culture, certainly to issues of nature and natural resources, a more open, a less closed system. In order to construct some of our models in economics and finance, we abstract from specific historical conditions to a more perfect model in order to understand the impacts of variables on each other, to understand how the system works. But that's not how reality works. That's always how a part of reality works, a representation through abstraction, right? But it potentially misleads us in some other ways because it leads us to neglect what is historically specific and the ways in which there are somewhat different institutional structures to capitalist economies. Capitalism has flourished and secured widespread legitimacy. Can I get rid of these? Only on the basis of a set of institutions and social relations that have been deeply damaged in recent decades. Its renewal will depend on their renewal. We can associate this, if you want to give it a name of a famous theorist, with the kind of thinking of Karl Polanyi about what he called a double movement in capitalism. That is, the existence of a growth engine, a dynamic part of capitalism that transformed economic activity and generated new wealth, but along the way caused what later Joseph Schumpeter would call creative destruction, that destroyed old industries as it created new industries, that changed things. That force of capitalism coexisted with attempts to repair some of the damage or restore various aspects of working conditions, living conditions for people in society. The forward momentum of dynamic growth often undercut the existing established institutions and ways of life of people. And that was often one-sided during periods of rapid growth. And then there would be another movement of trying to rebuild institutions to provide a wider sharing of the benefits of growth and a greater stability to the society, because the one-sided development would create upheavals. We've been going through a period in the West of a considerable amount of this social destruction of institutions and some momentum of dramatic new technological changes, positive increases in the economy. It's been one-sided in the direction of growth. I think this is not a completely different story in China, for what it's worth, although my main emphasis will be on the West, not the connection. That is to say, China has achieved a remarkable story of growth in recent years, nearly miraculous and nearly unprecedented. But it has achieved it while at the same time weakening, if not destroying, a variety of older institutions that have also been important to social life in China. Some of this can be described as the transition from communist institutions to capitalists, if you want to use this language, but I think it only partly gets the story. It isn't just about one political system or another political system or economic systems. It's about something that happens recurrently, that it's very hard for a capitalist economy to have a completely balanced growth pattern. It's something that can be strived for, but the farther it gets out of balance, the greater the social tensions and the greater the issues that are at stake. And China, too, has had a very unbalanced growth pattern. Unbalanced regionally, some parts of the country have had spectacular economic growth. Some parts of the country have had much less economic growth. And that creates issues and tensions. Spectacular in the inequality that it's produced in various cities, including here, in leading centers, where even with a lot of growth, the distribution of the benefits of that growth have been very uneven, and it leaves people in very different positions. And indeed, even very unequal across sectors, so that parts of the economy have moved dramatically forward, and other parts have been less advanced, and now become issues where the government, indeed, in the recent end of the MPC conference, begins to say, we have to work on this. There's perhaps no clearer example of this than the way in which one-sided growth creates externalities, creates bad effects, the costs of which are borne by someone else other than the beneficiary or producer of the growth. Okay? So firms, enterprises, whether state-owned or private, doesn't matter, are often able to externalize some of the costs. Air pollution is a simple example. And the issue of breathing is a very basic one to people. Everyone I know wants to go on breathing. Right? No objections, no controversies, not a matter of taste. Yet, it is a fundamental issue in a variety of Chinese cities that there has been such dramatic increase in air pollution, and it's been linked to growth, but not yet experienced this compensatory second movement of adequate social handling. In the West, the pattern is a little bit different, but not completely different. From the Great Depression and the era of World War II through to the 1970s, there was a large-scale building of what are often called welfare states, but building of state apparatus, and also to some extent of other ways of supporting citizens and people in their lives, charitable institutions, for example, some of them religious, that also flourished and created a substantial civil society basis for public support as well. What I want to talk about is not that period and the building of all these institutions, but that period saw capitalist growth combined with social growth, economic and social, largely similar, largely balanced, not perfectly, but significantly. From the 1970s, we saw dramatic changes. The first bit of those changes linked to the financialization that is crucial to the financial crisis and to understanding it. And I'm going to start off with that, but we need to see, we will see, a set of other changes as well. Right? So let me begin first with, if you will, a little bit of story set in the 1970s, then turn to a bit of analysis of what's going on today. The story that's set in the 1970s is crucial because it involves a period when there's the other major downturn, the recession 74-75, that has marked the period since the Great Depression. This downturn brought to an end a long pattern of growth in the West that had continued since the Great Depression. That growth had reduced inequality in every rich economy of the West, in every Western society. In economy, every OECD country, if you want to put it that way, which includes some non-Western societies, the level of inequality, right, went down from World War II until somewhere in the 1970s. Okay? And in the 1970s, it started going back up, accompanying the financialization. So what happened in the 1970s? Right? A number of things, and I'll make the story relatively short, but a number of things happened. The first was the financing of the last several years of the Vietnam War on credit. The U.S. war in Vietnam, right, whatever else you think of it, whether you think it was a wonderful project or an imperialist project or whatever else, became unpopular to such a degree that by the very end of the 1960s, then President Richard Nixon, 69-70, concluded that it would be impossible to pass any new taxes to support the Vietnam War. And so for the last 5.5 years of the war, until it ended in 75, it was financed mostly on credit by issuing government bonds, by having the government owe more, also a little bit by having the government print more money. But basically, right, during this period, there was a big expansion in credit. It also marked the beginning of the period when the U.S. government began to run deficits for which it borrowed internationally, something that would accelerate 20 years later with China as the major source of credit to the U.S., an unusual situation in which the poorer country was loaning to the richer country on a very large scale. That also became part of this growing financialization. It was adding to the amount of the world's wealth that was held in various forms of debt instruments, of finance in that sense. The change in the 1970s was influenced by other things besides that Vietnam War financing. The breakup of the old exchange rate agreements in the world took place during this period. It was cemented by Richard Nixon again when he withdrew unilaterally from the Bretton Woods Agreement, ending the convertibility of the U.S. currency. And the pound had lost its credibility at about the same time. So you had an end to specie convertibility. That is, no longer gold. You couldn't cash in your dollars for gold directly. Okay? The U.S. dollar became a fiat currency at this point. Right? It's just backed by the government. Now, this produced a variety of changes in the world system. And I'm just going to catalog a few. I'm not going to try to explain any either. About the same time, the Yom Kippur War, a war between Israel and a set of Arab states around it, was a significant political issue that we should also remember as an economic issue. Because it was in response to the Yom Kippur War in 73 that the OPEC countries, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, instituted a boycott, a kind of strike on oil supplies to the rest of the world that dramatically transformed the price of oil, which went from $3 a barrel to over 100. Right? Dramatic increase, not overnight, but over a period of a couple years in this period. So oil prices were hugely changed. That was one of the precipitating factors of the 74-75 recession, the crisis that happened there, contribute to a whole variety of things in the West, including eventually the rise of Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, politics, issues in the world of the Middle East, like the Iranian Revolution, 1979, lots of impacts. But very immediately, one of the impacts is it created lots more wealth in the hands of countries that could not immediately absorb that wealth in productive investments. That is, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait and Qatar and so forth were not able to absorb all of this new wealth in building factories and employing citizens, and in some cases didn't have the citizens to employ. So this is a long-term story about what happens there, but a short-term part of it is this creates the wave of modern sovereign wealth funds. The Emirates Wealth Fund, the largest and most significant of these sovereign wealth funds that emerges precisely then, immediately after the, in 75, immediately after the Yom Kippur War and the OPEC oil boycott. What it does is it takes enormous amounts of wealth, and there are similar ones in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and so forth, invests it globally. Note again, it's more finance capital in the system of the world economy. And this has a transformation. This is part of that movement from finance capital accounting for 25% of capital to 75%. Okay? Now, there's more to this story, but I'm going to leave out the rest of it, a bit about the 70s, because the important thing to notice is you get a huge change, and you get it in ways that you cannot single out and say it's just economic or it's just political, right? It's mixed. It's even culture and religion mixed in. That the actual history has these different strands mixed together. Now, you could abstract out from that and ask about how the capital markets work by themselves, but how this came about was entwined histories of multiple dimensions. Okay? It has a variety of short-term and long-term effects as it marks this period of change. This period of change is the period of the rise of the new microelectronics industries, right? Apple computer is invented at the established at the same moment as that Abu Dhabi United Arab Emirates sovereign wealth fund. It is a product of the same period. So is Microsoft and a series of related changes. They have to do with a combined set of processes, which to telescope them really briefly, include the use of all of this new financial wealth to back the creation of new businesses and their very rapid scaling up, right, so that Apple can quickly become a fairly large company, Microsoft even faster in some ways. That change a variety of people's lives as all these new technologies go out, that change labor markets and so forth, but that depend on a set of technologies that have been developed by the Western states, especially the United States, during the post-war period as government-funded research. Almost all the basic underlying technologies on which these new computer and electronic technologies depended was developed by government-funded research largely for defense purposes during the era of the Cold War, partly out of medical research budgets, and funded with, you know, spin-offs from the sending people to the moon, and that would yield employment for engineers and technological advances that would then be influenced. The government approached all of this for its purposes, defense, medicine, moon races, but made this technology publicly available without charging for it, and indeed invested to some extent in getting it out. So the internet was created on the basis, as we know by Tim Berners-Lee and others of coming up with addressing systems, on the basis of what was called ARPANET, the Advanced Research Projects Administration Network. The Advanced Research Projects Administration, better known as DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Administration of the Pentagon in the United States, which first established all this technology. Now, the point of that is you had a role of government in doing a kind of research, investing a lot in research, more than any business or entrepreneur would easily have invested in research. And in that period, corporations were investing more in research, AT&T with Bell Labs and others, because they were very long-term consistent corporations than later. But lots was invested in research, way beyond any immediate economic payoff. Okay? It wasn't invested simply on a capitalist basis to make more money. It was invested for power and defense, the Cold War. But starting in the 1970s, a group of entrepreneurs, of independent individual actors, some of whom became capitalists, although they didn't necessarily think of themselves that way at the beginning, built new consumer technologies and companies that became huge and important and transformative, using the government-funded research and the capital that came from these new financial markets to take completely new products forward. And this launched huge, and I think in many ways, quite productive technological revolutions, changes in consumer goods, changes in the world economy. So this all moves forward, but it also launches a variety of other things. It launches a process of the development of new financial instruments that will take us, in a very rapid version of the story, to 2008 March and the market meltdown. Because it's in this context that there get to be a variety of new structures, the emergence of hedge funds in their modern form, derivatives, that is financial instruments that are essentially bets on the prices of other assets, various other kinds of complex instruments, credit default swaps, and so forth, all of which are built into this new world of finance. And at the same time, it begins a process of dramatically increasing inequality, which is mostly accepted partly because there is an implicit payoff, a social contract. You get cool new devices. It's shared to some extent with the remnants of the welfare state, but a social contract that begins to break down now in the context of the economic crisis. So when I say threats to global capitalism, the first threat to global capitalism to look at is what's called systemic risk. Right? Systemic risk. During this period of financialization, right, the system became vastly more interconnected. The nature of the interconnections often became opaque and vulnerable to disruptions that couldn't be easily anticipated. The example of Lehman Brothers being allowed to fold in the early days of the financial crisis in 2008 is an illustration of this. When the decisions were made, people in the US Treasury, to allow Lehman Brothers to collapse but to rescue some other firms in the early days of the financial crisis, they didn't know for sure who would benefit and who would be vulnerable. In particular, they didn't know for sure how many other firms would be affected by the collapse of Lehman Brothers. The answer was lots. The system that had been built up was far more closely interconnected than previous versions of capitalist economic systems or of other economic systems. The finance could move rapidly around the world using these new technologies so that we had markets that could quickly drain money from one country, locate it in another country, right, as well as from one business to another business. And we had a more and more short-term look at the market in general. But we also had this new kind of vulnerability to systemic risk, that is, to the problems that came simply from being tightly interconnected. Many of the new financial technologies involved, like the derivatives, were developed initially to be protections against financial risk. Right? They were often insurance, they were used as hedges, but they were integrated into a system that created invisible counterparties, right? People who were affected when any one bankruptcy occurred, when any one business went down, because it owed money to other businesses, because other businesses held assets which were constructed as derivatives based on values of assets in the first company, and so forth and so on, throughout many complex links in the chain. The expression that was often used, too big to fail, for some of these companies that were bailed out by Western taxpayers during this period, slightly a misnomer. What they really were is too connected to fail. What was really being said was these companies are so tightly interconnected that if we allow them to fail, they might pull down the whole financial apparatus because there are so many interlocking arrangements of debt and it's so difficult to tell exactly how they total up. This is what then drew Europe into a large part of this financial crisis. The financial crisis, you may remember, looked initially like it was mainly American. The mortgage-backed securities industry was at the heart of the financial crisis, at the heart of that moment of the financial crisis. That is, that there had been a bubble in assets, all kinds of assets, during this long period of financialization, including house values. So that the values of apartments and houses went up. You'll say, well, that would never happen in China. There would never be widespread speculation in apartments, which might even stand empty with no one using them, just waiting to sell them again. Or maybe you would say that about China, right? The point is, there was a huge speculative bubble in home prices. People borrowed money to buy homes more than they could afford or more than they needed because they just wanted to make money in this boom. And there was a huge buyout. And it wasn't limited to the United States. It extended to real estate markets all around Europe, and not just to people's houses, to vacation homes. Developments on the Dalmatian coast in the former Yugoslavia were built up on all kinds of these deals of heavily leveraged, mortgaged assets. But then an invention was made of the mortgage-backed security, which meant instead of a bank loaning somebody money and saying, oh, you look like a good, trustworthy person, you have a good job, I'll loan you money, you pay me back over the next 20 years or something, the mortgages were sold to agencies, right? Basically, sales companies went out and sold the mortgages and then bundled them together into securities and sold shares in those securities on the market, right? Which again leveraged capital. Okay? So there was more finance, that is, more wealth was being held in the form of a financial asset. The mortgage-backed security also had the effect of mixing good mortgages and bad, and selling the control of these mortgages to people who had no idea whose houses they were financing. Right? And yet those were treated as capital base for other loans and leverage. So banks that owned these mortgage-backed securities were allowed to treat them as the same as owning mortgages from individual householders in their local areas and so forth. They become more vulnerable. So a crisis in these mortgage-backed securities tipped off the immediate market sell-off at the end of that led to the financial crisis. But what hadn't been fully anticipated was how much European banks had invested in these sorts of assets and in various kinds of financial instruments that linked them to it. So in the first year of the financial crisis, one could hear frequently, as an American, sympathy from Europeans, but with a certain view of, well, thank God we don't have this kind of risky system. Okay? But then it began to be apparent that Europe did have this kind of risky system. Britain knew it sooner, it was more like the US in this, and it knew it with banks failing, with Northern Rock crisis came very early, but then with the National Bank of Scotland, Royal Bank of Scotland, and the RBS failure, which was a huge failure in Britain, which brought its own government bailout, and the Royal Bank of Scotland remains owned to this day, majority by the British taxpayers. It's trying to emerge from this. And ripple effects were everywhere. Then they were felt in Spain, and in Greece, and in Italy, and in Portugal, and in a series of other countries. And these ripple effects are more evidence of what I'm calling systemic risk. That is the tightly interconnected character of everything, where part of the risk is in the system pulling other people in, right? Not just the risk of any one instrument, but that it's all multiplied by this systemic character. We actually have an excellent new center at the LSE to study systemic risk. Okay. Now, as this spread into Europe, European countries found that they had a problem with banks that were vulnerable and to a very large extent opted to bail out the banks. Right? Bailing out the banks moved the banks' vulnerable assets onto the government's balance sheets to an increasing extent. This exacerbated fiscal crises, that is, crises in the government's budgets, in the government's accounts. Government accounts were already not always strong, but you had now a huge amount of new debt problems for the government because they were trying to keep up the banks in their different nation states. This process, right, went on and combined with the crises of the economies in those countries. Right? Housing prices fell, which created more problems for the banks and the financial system. Right? And you ended up with this crisis through much of the European Union, and indeed endangering the European Union to this day, as it does with Cyprus. But I'll come back to Cyprus in a moment. Right? What you had first, right, was this set of systemic risks that had moved from being directly economic or financial, they were risks in the banking and loan system, to becoming political because they were now the debts of sovereign countries which could not readily issue bonds at reasonable interest rates because of the way their balance sheets looked. So they couldn't borrow, so they couldn't work, so they couldn't pay pensions, and they began to not pay pensions. They couldn't pay policemen and firemen, and there began to be all the problems that we see that lead to protests in the street in Greece or other places. Right? So we get this all sort of playing out as a series of interconnections that play that are dependent first on there being so much finance and then on crises in the systemic risk process, the risks embedded in the complex web of internal connections that make up the modern financial system. So in trying to understand the crisis, we need to be clear, it's not a crisis of capitalism in general, it's particularly about this role of finance and a highly leveraged version of capitalism, where huge amounts of borrowed money are driving the system, and in which it's tightly interconnected between government and economy. It's not the mythological, pure free market system in which governments don't intervene into the market. The market works by itself. It's a system that is closely interconnecting the two. And it makes over-leveraging, excessive risk-taking very problematic. And during the same period, neoliberalism, which I mentioned at the beginning, complements the financialization because it's an era of deregulation or failure to produce new regulations. Hedge funds were never really regulated because they were a new sort of invention and no regulations were developed. Some other things like banking used to be regulated and governments cut back on the regulations in the pursuit of economic growth and international competitiveness. And this all helped to shape the crisis. Now, government action was actually crucial to heading off the further unraveling of this crisis, and it remains crucial to resilience and growth. Governments, corporations, others, etc., will very likely, I think, eventually lead to resumed growth in the West, though possibly never to the similar sorts of momentum in the West. And what I want to do now is to turn against this backdrop and speak a little bit about what threatens us beyond systemic risk, beyond the financial crisis, beyond these unravelings, and relate that to China as well as to the rest. And the first part of the relationship is that this whole process, not just the financial crisis, but the 30 years of financialization before it, the neoliberal policies, deeply undermined the global leadership in capitalist society of the rich Western economies, particularly those in Europe and North America. That is, that the capacity to be the forward driving force of global capitalism was partly undercut by these sort of phenomena. Now, at the same time, though, the same processes encouraged development in China, Korea, Malaysia, and other non-Western economies in Brazil, right, even in South Africa and elsewhere. A range of non-Western economies received openings to move more effectively into the global capitalist system, sometimes aided by the very transferability of assets and by the policies that led to partial deindustrialization in the West. In the UK, for example, and in the United States, there was a dramatic reduction in manufacturing employment, more extreme in the UK. The number of jobs making things went down, factories went down. That kind of industry moved very heavily to other parts of the world, including especially East Asia, right, with a shift. And this set in motion part of the economic miracle of a number of Asian countries, as there was a deindustrialization, the old leading economies, right, in favor of finance, the money that can be made from finance, industry grew right here. The situation, though, it rests on shaky foundations. What we have is a set of Western economies in which there is essentially no growth in Europe. Right? Europe has not seen net growth for 5 years, going on six. There's growth in a couple of European economies, like Germany, not coincidentally the European economy that kept the most manufacturing jobs, that did the most to retain manufacturing instead of send it abroad. Right? When BMW opened factories in Japan, in China, they didn't close their factories in Germany. They became a worldwide manufacturing firm. Much less true in some other cases. IBM could wind up selling its personal computer business to Lenovo, partly because it had completely sent manufacturing offshore. Right? It was already all being made here. So there's this sort of thing going on. The foundations are weak in Europe. In addition, European economies had evolved versions of the welfare state that were extremely expensive and hard to support, especially with that tax base going down. The U.S. wasn't in quite as bad a situation, and it has a bit more growth now, but it's sort of the same story. To speed up the conclusion, right, what we have are a variety of economies, China is one of them, and other places, that have a slightly different version of the story, which is underwriting dramatic economic growth in China, and leaving an open question of whether this is going to bring some of the new kinds of institutional developments to manage the change. So the principal threats we face can be summed up in a sort of short list: politics, weak social institutions, and environment. But I want to expand this before I close. Right? What are the big threats to capitalism besides internal systemic crisis? Right? Lots of attention is focused on that. The first is the failure of states, of governments, to provide the necessary conditions for capitalist reproduction. For capitalism, like anything else to go on, it requires conditions. It requires educated and skilled workers. It requires infrastructure, roads, waste management system for cities, all kinds of things that are simply necessary for the continued working of the system. And we need to worry about this. This is where Europe and the US are in serious trouble. You see the Republican and Democratic parties in the US Congress unable to work together enough to pass a variety of basic sorts of legislation. And you see a state which is unable to secure the conditions for continued capitalist investment and growth. Now, the US may recover despite the government, but governments play an important role in creating conditions, everything from money to roads, for continued capitalist enterprise. A further issue is informalization. That is, when the governments don't provide necessary conditions for life and economic life, people with money attempt to buy them in markets. And so there's a growing market system. Right? But this growing market system only works for some people, and it is vulnerable to a great deal of corruption. And there are two kinds of corruption, if you will, and two kinds of what I've called informalization. That is, moving outside the official, legally recorded versions of capitalism. One of these is pretty small scale. That is, small scale alternatives like local cooperatives in which people help each other out, exchanging services, sometimes even developing alternative currencies. And in every major city in Europe, and for that matter, much of North America, and large parts of the developing world, Latin America and elsewhere, there are now extensive informal economies that are small scale. They don't replace global corporate capitalism, they don't really compete with it, but they keep people alive by small scale exchanges of various kinds of goods and services. Farmers who trade their produce fairly directly for goods or services, say shoes, clothes, for their children from cities, and do it outside the formal capitalist system. They don't go to a store to do it, they do it directly. Right? This kind of informal trade was first, the name informal sector was given in Ghana, right, in the 1970s. And it's a version of something seen in underdeveloped economies, but it's now seen throughout Europe. Right? One of the most developed centers of this is Barcelona, where some 200,000 people subsist largely on this basis. There would be hunger, there would be major public disorder in many European countries were it not for informal economies that sustain people. So this is big. China has versions of the same thing. Okay? But equally, there's a large scale version of this. Right? Very large scale version of it, and this we see in the Cyprus situation. Cyprus, this small island state off of Greece that is a member of the European Union and potentially going to bring it down in the next day or two, although I will hope that is averted. Right? You've read about, I hope, in the last couple of days, the crisis in Cyprus, which involves yet another set of bailouts of one country's banking system by the European Union. This time, unlike in all the previous cases, the European Union imposed a kind of tax penalty on all the deposits in all those banks. In all of the previous bailouts in Europe, taxpayers have been made to pay the bills, and those with money in the banks have not paid the costs in general. There have been varying degrees of what are called haircuts, that is, bondholders have paid the costs in some part of the interest rates. Now, in this case, there's a big penalty imposed. It's a question of whether Cyprus will absorb it. But the fact about Cyprus that may or may not be evident is, what is the economy in Cyprus? Well, it's tourism a little bit. There's tourism, not really active right at the moment. Mm-hmm. That's an economic problem, right? And it's banking. If you look at the World Bank statistics on foreign direct investment in the world, you'll find that Cyprus is the largest investor in Russia. Now, what's going on with this little tiny island country being the largest investor in Russia, which is a large economy? And what's going on, to put it short, is money laundering. What's going on is Russian money evading taxes and government control in Russia, going to Cyprus, where it is then reinvested in Russia in various kinds of business enterprises. And this is one of the reasons for this particular Cyprus situation. Now, I don't want to sort of dwell on Cyprus. What I want to dwell on is the fact that there is, as a threat to global economic growth and global capitalism, an enormous amount of offshore, unrecorded, untaxed, unregulated capitalism. Some of it is just ordinary businesses, like an oil or gas business, operated in a partially illegal fashion without paying taxes. But it also connects to the global trade in arms, and it connects to the global drug trade. It connects to the issue of minerals in Africa, from diamonds to molybdenum, and the trade in these commodities, and the largely illicit trade that often gets involved in wars and warlord relations and these sorts of things, because there's a huge sector of this kind, trillions and trillions of pounds worth. Right? In addition to this growth of an alternative kind of economy that is largely offshore and unrecorded, there's a failure to rebuild damaged social institutions in the West, or to build adequate new institutions elsewhere. So there's a problem, right? It runs with everything from education to healthcare to care for the aged and so forth in a variety of societies. I don't dwell on that. There's increased inequality and a crisis of legitimacy as people doubt whether the gains of capitalism, the gains of the new economy, are being shared with them enough to make it worth their while to comply with the system. And whenever people begin to doubt that, quite aside from whether there's enough public rest to bring down the government, it brings up costs, because it is much more expensive to be able to manage unhappiness than it is to be able to deal with a largely compliant population. Right? So a basic issue in China is, to what extent do people feel that the gains of economic growth are beneficial enough to them? Or do they feel that local officials have taken their property illegitimately in order to sell it to a developer? Or do they feel that there's some other kind of corruption in the system enough that there is a continuing proliferation of various sorts of protests which have to be policed or bought off and which impose a number of costs on the system as well as threats? Then there's environmental degradation and potentially climate change on a large scale. The system, unchecked, right, and with relatively minimal environmental regulation still, I mean, think of it, very hard to breathe in Beijing most days. I was lucky enough to fly in a snowstorm, a freak snowstorm, at the end of the winter, beginning of spring. So my first day in Beijing was clear, and everybody kept saying, wow, this day is amazing. Look, I saw blue sky for this morning for 2 hours. Right? We live in a setting where we tolerate, for a while, basic things like not being able to see the sky or breathe. Right? And around the world, there are a variety of kinds of degradation of the environment, serious problems, and there's very strong scientific evidence of large-scale climate change on a global level that could literally put whole island countries underwater. So we have a massive threat there, because basically being underwater means you cannot any longer participate in the capitalist economy. And while there's money to be made in the sale of life rafts, it's not enough money, right, to compensate what's lost in these sorts of exchanges. So this is genuinely a threat to capitalism. Then finally, there's war. It's not just politics in the sense of the American system being stuck and unable to move, or the question of whether there's political will to put Europe back together. It is the potential for large-scale conflict between countries over resources, and the environmental problems may aggravate that, but the conflict over islands in the sea, which has something to do with national pride and a lot to do with potential oil reserves in various places, is simply an example of this. China has a version of it, but not the only versions of it. There are others around the world of these sorts of potentials for war. Now, all of this, right, could be treated as a story about the West, and the crisis after the 2007-2008 meltdown of the highly financial system. But it has big elements here, too. I want to close with just noting some of these. Right? This issue of the failure of states to provide necessary conditions for capitalist reproduction, right, is also the question of whether Chinese state, which has done remarkably well creating the conditions for economic growth so far, can create the conditions for the next stage of that growth to a higher level. There are good reasons to think it can, but there are real questions about just what those conditions are, how they will be achieved, how that will be organized, and how it will be made to benefit China as a whole. But it's a challenge. It's one the government's quite aware of and working on, that its challenge is not to do the same things that made possible the first wave of China's rapid economic growth. Right, that those things won't work again in the same way, partly because China needs to move to new levels of capitalism. For example, to take something that is significant in Shanghai, China needs to get into the design industries. It needs to not just be a manufacturing country, but a country that is doing the design of devices like this. That's a higher value added part of the supply chain for these industries. It takes a different set of skills, it takes a different regulatory environment, and it's very significant. It takes a different orientation to the outside, because it takes being in a position to be able to design consumer devices that will be marketed in many different countries of the world, and thus to be able to do market research and intelligence gathering and think about this on a different world scale. It's no longer a matter of low wages, it's a matter of effective high-wage employment in a different kind of industry. The Shanghai Design Expo and things show us that China has the ability and the desire to get into this, but it remains to be seen how successfully China will compete moving into that next higher value-added stage of capitalist development. And this is partly a matter of for the state. It's partly a matter of just whether private enterprise will do it, but it's a matter of education, the development of the programs that are needed. It's not just science and technology, right, to go into design, it's other things. And the same can be said for a variety of other areas. The issue of informalization has its analog here in the issue of corruption. There's small-scale corruption that just enables people to get along in life. And you may object to Guanxi, and you may object to Guanxi kind of things, especially when they become so constant that they're a headache. But what many people object to more is the substitution of a direct cash payment for the personal relationship version of Guanxi, and the extent to which officials or others who control some good are demanding an extra side payment as a straight cash payment. Not just they're trying to favor their nephew or something like that, but give me the money right now. And the give me the money right now version, even then, has problems because then the families that were otherwise being sustained a little bit by these connections don't necessarily benefit. Individuals gather more of it to themselves. So there's a problem with the small-scale corruption. Even it can be a headache. But the big issue is the larger-scale corruption, right? And we know that the current government, the new government, is interested in trying to crack down a bit, to find some exemplars. It's arrested one general. It's doing various. It's making moves, right? We don't know how far it will be able to rein in systemic corruption. But it's clearly right for the government to see this as a basic problem. We just don't know how far it will go and how serious it will be about dealing with the problem of official corruption. But that's very much the domestic version of the same thing that goes on in all that Russian money going to Cyprus. Then this issue of rebuilding damaged social institutions. Well, in the transition from the earlier Mao-era kinds of social institutions, the work unit and so forth, to the modern, more flexible, rapidly growing capitalist economy, China lost certain kinds of institutional supports for some people, particularly for less well-off people in the society. In the transition from rural to urban, people who moved lost family support systems that they had in villages and didn't have to the same degree in cities. And the question is, can new institutions be built fast enough to take care of these people? China has now an aging population. It has been a remarkably young country. It's becoming an aging country. As there are more older people, where will they live? Who will take care of them? How will this work? It's not just a one-child family story. It's a story of a variety of different kinds of pressures. But those pressures add up to a real challenge when there are going to be every year more and more older people, the majority of whom are not beneficiaries of the large-scale economic growth. They are not the ones who've profited most from the actual successes of the system. So China has a need to build social institutions. The issue of inequality is a basic issue, right? How much inequality will people tolerate? How is it organized? What do we do about it? Does it seem fair? The environmental issues I've already mentioned, even the threats of war. Now, the point of this isn't to say all those things are going to happen. The point of this is to say those are the threats. Those are the things that threatened capitalism in the West and continued economic growth in China. And therefore, they are the challenges. They are the issues that the new government must deal with, and they're the issues that all of you will deal with, because the government won't be able to deal with them all on its own. They will require continued social change and innovation. They will require corporations that work in somewhat different ways. They will require the development of small-scale enterprises, social enterprises, charitable organizations. They will require a kind of innovation in China on the social side to match what has been going on for the last 20 years on the economic side. My own bet is on China. I think China will succeed in this, but it's a big set of challenges. If China succeeds in it, I think this will be part of a transition to a world economy in which China is fully one of the leaders, in which talking about catching up no longer makes sense. Right? But that's the next 20 years, and that's a set of questions we have to think about. Thank you for joining the thinking tonight. Anyone has any questions, comments, or contradictions? They would be welcome. This is an LSE audience, so contradictions are especially welcome. Yeah.
Thank you for the very interesting lecture, and I'm very interested in what you talked about, the integrated system, supposedly the globalization, I suppose. One question is, how do you think people come into this integrated system, how information get transferred during that process? I'm really interested in information and how institutions play in the role of setting boundary or freeing the information. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a terrific question, because obviously information is at the heart of this very integration. Some of the information is, of course, the financial transactions themselves of an integrated financial system. Each of these is, from one perspective, information for all the other actors in the system who can have a view on it. And part of the issue with the systemic risk is that the information isn't entirely transparent and is very hard for people to see. So that the incentive systems would be aligned very differently if you could tell all of the counterparties to a financial transaction. That is, if you could tell everybody else who was affected by it and everyone could see it, in a sense. It's not legible. The information is problematic in its aggregation because most of these large-scale financial engineering efforts, first, are not required by regulatory systems to be made transparent. You might say that a definition of a hedge fund is not subject to the requirements of disclosure that most public companies are subject to. So hedge funds, as a sort of, if you want to take that as a class of organizations, right, don't just engage in hedging. They use instruments that were often hedging instruments as primary investment vehicles, and they don't disclose what they hold because they feel that if they did, they would lose their competitive edge in the market. But what that means is you then have a variety of relationships that where the information is not fully available, and there's no regulatory agreement on how much should be made fully available. And if one actor in the system demanded disclosure, there would be a temptation for the hedge funds simply to move to other places and operate in other countries with different regulatory regimes. And we don't have a really global financial regulatory regime now. So that's one part of the problem. The other part of the problem is the sheer complexity of the trading of these things in the markets, often aided by computerized trading systems, momentum trading, all this sort of thing. But the basic issue is that where a good, say those mortgage-backed securities they talked about, right, is bundled together out of lots of other things, each of those individual mortgages put into a big thing, then it's sliced up because we're going to sell shares in the whole thing. We're not selling the individual mortgages off, we're selling shares in the composite product. And then the shares are traded and traded again and perhaps traded 100 times in the market. It's very hard to know, right, where it's gone. And then if it is used as collateral on a loan or collateral for a bank to make a loan as the basic capital of the bank, which it often is, right, then you've got something that you're going to treat as a stable sort of collateral. But in fact, it's very hard to assess what vulnerability is involved in it. So it's very hard to have the necessary economic information. And even if some of the regulatory conditions changed, it would still be hard because of that complexity. So those are examples of where there's an intrinsic information difficulty. I'm not saying there's no solution, but we would have to see as much creativity go into producing a more transparent information system as has gone into hiding it on one hand, or in developing the new financial technologies on the other. And so far, that's not happening. Now, there are other kinds of information that do circulate much more widely and where governments sometimes try to block it, internet access or things like that. So there are other sorts of information worlds where it's much more in principle transparent, but there are actors trying to block it, like governments that don't want people Googling Tiananmen or something like that. These sorts of things are also issues about free flow of information. And I will give you my somewhat unhappy prediction, which is, I think this is getting worse. I think that there was, in the early days of the internet, a widespread view that information wants to be free, and that the basic direction of development would be more internet, more uses of new technology, more freedom of information. I think what's going to happen is we are going to lose our privacy and not get widespread public information in return. We're going to get a combination of commercial, proprietarial attempts to control information on the one hand, you can buy it, and government attempts to block it on the other hand. And so while there will still be lots of creative things going on, they will be up against much bigger obstacles than we look at. Yeah, Christian.
Again, thank you for the excellent lecture. I wonder, isn't there an underlying assumption in the title of your lecture that capitalism is a good thing and that growth is a good thing? And I wonder, hasn't there also been a shift in recent years from the economy being the constraint to the environment, to the environment now becoming the constraint to the economy, which means that growth is being questioned? Let's say Tim Jackson, prosperity without growth, and all those ideas. What do you think about that debate? Or couldn't you say, what are the opportunities in capitalism failing?
Yeah. I think there's a significant argument. You're exactly right. There's a widespread but not majority view that capitalism is itself the problem, and it is the problem partly because it produces growth. Growth exhausts available resources. Growth creates all those externalities like environmental problems and, for that matter, inequality. And we'd be better off without it. I did choose to start with the assumption and the phrasing of it, what threatens capitalism, because of taking the point of view of the system. But I think you could start the other way around and say, and do a good analysis on the lines of, if what you wanted was to protect the environment, how would you be able to manage or limit or possibly get rid of capitalism to save the environment? And you could try to do the analysis that way. I don't, simply because I think so many people and so much of the world system is still invested in growth, that the calamities of a breakdown in the growth system are potentially very large. So I am unable to convince myself that there is a happy scenario in which we move towards prosperity without growth, to follow that particular argument, because what I see are so many potentials for catastrophic issues, wars, and collapses of systems in that path. So I'm personally very attracted. I'm still a child of the 1960s, and I'm attracted to a sort of view of a smaller scale society organized in more communal ways, in which the having enough would be the goal, not always trying to have more. I find that a very attractive vision. But I'm chastened since my 1960s youth by the extent to which I think the nature of a breakdown would be such that it would create so many problems that it would be serious, and the investment in the existing system is so large that I hope for a gradual change rather than a abrupt one, and I hope for one that can be worked out to bring larger parts of the economy, not to the kind of excess that goes on in U.S. consumption patterns, or for that matter, the consumption of the very rich in Shanghai, but to a level of economic inclusion and sufficiency. But for this purpose, my purpose is to sort of think this through from the point of view of the capitalist system. But I want to affirm, I think you're right, that you could take the opposite approach and start saying, how soon will capitalism collapse and what good things might follow from that? But I think that we ought to recognize that some pretty worrying things would also probably follow from that. In the back.
Thank you very much for the informative lectures. I have two questions. One is, you talk about the informal economy, especially the alternative offshore economy, and what kind of threat being posed to the mainstream economy. Do you have any recommendations on how or who should, either the government or international organizations or private sector or market, can do to incorporate the offshore alternative economy into the mainstream? Or how do you regulate that sector? My second question is, you seem to have a very optimistic view on China, especially on the last comments at the end of the lecture. I have a hypothetical question, I would say. So if you are the senior advisor to the top leadership in China, like Xi Jinping or Li Keqiang, what would you recommend them for the next 10 years, what they should do?
Find a new top senior advisor.
Thank you, Sarah.
Okay, two good challenging questions. Let me try to break them. I'll answer the second one, and you'll probably have to remind me what the first one was by that point. But I have an optimistic view on China, because I think China has lots of potential resilience to work through these problems. I think these are big problems for China, and let me make clear that I think failing to address these problems will be fatal. I mean, it will really lead to an end to this happy period of of growth, but beyond that, it will lead to internal strife. So I think that the environmental problem, the social institutional problems, and so forth, are critical problems for China, and that it really is crucial that they're dealt with. And I think that the consequences, right, are worse than the consequences people usually point to. They point to, there'll be a slowdown, and China won't get to be as rich as the United States. The consequences become that happens, and it gets coupled with potential international conflicts or with domestic discord and strife. And so it's not just an economic slowdown anymore. It has these other consequences. The issue of me giving advice, a sort of preposterous idea, but I like it, to the leadership in this, say, take these problems very seriously, as the short answer, and in make them foci of investment, but also long-term investment in opening up the system to creative invention by Chinese people of solutions to these problems. I think it's very hard to imagine they will all be figured out on a top-down basis. And so if the system isn't opened up to a variety of other ways of coming up with solutions, it's going to be very, very hard to meet these problems. And I think that that's a serious issue. I think that actually goes to some extent for the economic issues too. I think that the next phase, say what I said about design and that sort of thing, also requires some different kind of openings and working in a different way. In a way, your first question is connected to the second one. And I'd answer it by saying I would start in China, but elsewhere, with inequality as the issue. I think the extremes of inequality are not only among the more dangerous things, but they get in the way of solving every other kind of problem. I think the extremes of inequality get in the way of solving the environmental problem. They get in the way of building the social institutions that are needed. And that efforts to regulate the economy will be very good, and efforts to ensure more transparency will be very good, but they will be evaded so long as the inequality is so extreme. And so the offshore capitalism and the domestic corruption go hand in hand with the increased inequality. They have both gone up because of dramatically more inequality in the system, individuals controlling billions and billions of dollars. I'd say it's a basic problem that we have as many billionaires as we have. Not because each one of them is individually morally bad, that's not the point, but because it reveals such a pull of the system towards extremes of inequality that it will be very hard to find ways to reform and get it to work better on each of these other issues, the environment or the aging population or whatever else. And so if China continues a course of development that keeps widening the inequality gap, as the US has done, right, it will have problems, and it will probably have more severe problems sooner than the US has done, because the US has had a very long time to invent compensatory institutions to try to minimize some of the effects of the extreme inequality. But it's a big problem in the US too. So that's my short answer on that. All right. Thank you all for coming, for asking good questions, for listening to me for a long time, and for being LLC alumni.